afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, go ahead and call in. We'll talk about them together and maybe get an answer, hopefully. If you have a different viewpoint from the host and want to call in about that, feel free to do so. We'll be glad to have that conversation as well. The number to call, and by the way, there are a couple of lines open right now, so you can get through if you call immediately, is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Our first caller today is John from Apple Valley, California. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. I finally finished reading your book about hell, and I gave a couple of copies to the pastors at the church I go to, and it's a good church. I think you'd be quite impressed with their teaching, although their view on hell is different from mine, and I don't think they're going to change it anytime soon.
Uh-huh.
And currently I'm slogging my way through your book on Revelation. That is a long book.
It is a long book. I haven't read through it since it first came out.
Yeah.
I've read the Hell book through more than once since it came out.
Sure. Over the weekend, they gave a sermon on God's justice, and their general conclusion is that, you know, God will judge everyone at the end of time on the day of judgment. But my question is regarding God's judgment in the earth throughout history. We see it evidenced in the Old Testament. And then based on what you've taught me about 80, 70, I see it there again. And I wonder about some of the more recent history, like World War II, the end, and how the Nazis were defeated. And the reason this question is on my mind, have you heard of a man called Mark Taylor, who wrote the Trump prophecies?
Well, yeah, people callers have brought him up before. I've never listened to him, but I do know of him.
Anyway, what his conclusion is, he's suggesting that God is now going to intervene in human history again with a sense of justice over those who are corrupt and have manipulated this country to do harm to the population and through their greed and all that sort of thing. So I just wondered on the question would be, what's your opinion about God intervening in human history in recent times?
Well, I pray for it regularly. I mean, when we pray, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven, we're praying for God's intervention in history to change things so they'd be more according to his will. As far as the specific things that I would think he would do in answer to prayers like that would be hopefully to, you know, redirect countries that are calling out to him or where a significant number of people are, into more paths of righteousness, as David mentions in Psalm 23, that he'll lead us into paths of righteousness. Now, if that's going to happen, then, of course, corrupt government will have to, you know, be defeated somehow. Now, in biblical times, the way corrupt governments were defeated was either by military coups or by wars, invading forces. Nowadays, that can be done through the ballot box, and so that might be the way that God would do it. He might also do it through the old-fashioned ways of war and so forth. But I think that, you know, I don't know to what degree there's been a turning to God in this country. I don't know if I've seen evidence of a major turning to God in this country, but I do believe that there are people waking up to some of the worst aspects of what's been going on for the past few decades here and wanting that to stop. Now, I know Christians, too. A lot of Christians are energized and encouraged by what's going on and hopefully are praying, perhaps fasting for the way the government's going to go. But do I believe God intervenes? I do. I believe God intervenes in all kinds of things. Remember, Jesus said that not a sparrow falls to the ground without the will of your Father. And the point he's making is sparrows are really not very important, but God even is paying attention to them. And it would appear that even their own death is somehow within his sovereign, you know, providence. So I do believe God is involved in the rise and fall of nations and in changes that take place in nations. Now, it's a little early to tell whether we've got something like a permanent change in this nation. I mean, obviously, some of the things that Mr. Trump has done have been applauded by Christians and conservatives. But, of course, they've been hated by a large number on the left, and so we might see a backlash in this, you know, the next election, for all we know, might be the end of the Trump agenda. It's entirely possible, because if his enemies, you know, gain power in the government through this next election, they'll certainly harass him and keep him from doing anything of value. So I'm not making any predictions, you know. I mean, it may be that God has given us a reprieve for a couple of years, and if the nation were to turn to God, I don't know, maybe he'll take the reforms further. I'm not a prophet, and that's one difference between myself and Mark Taylor. He claims to be a prophet. I don't. So I'm an observer. I look at what's going on, and I think about it, but that's about the most I can say. I can't tell you what's going on.
Yes, I think we'll all have to wait to see regarding Mark Taylor. I'm quite optimistically hoping that it's true, because it's all good news.
Of course.
One of the things that I think about since becoming a millennialist, which you did a lot to help me to understand that, is that the prophecy or the parable of Jesus regarding the mustard seed, and then Isaiah mm-hmm. with the stone that was cut without hands filling the earth. If you look at recent history, you see the growth of the church, and it seems at this point in time it's kind of stagnant. And so I'm looking for something to happen that causes a spurt in growth in the truth of God on earth, because surely if he is building his kingdom, it will grow and it will become very large. And so something would have to happen to get more people on the narrow path again.
Sure. And you know,
real growth.
You know, a lot of people, when you talk about the kingdom of God growing and, you know, making conquests in history and so forth, they'll say, what, aren't you paying attention? Don't you see that Christianity is declining in the world? Don't you see that, you know, things are getting worse? But they're not really looking very far. Christianity is not declining in the world. It's growing rapidly in Asia and in Africa and South America, which have some of the biggest populations in the world. It's not growing very fast in the United States at this moment, as you say. It's kind of stagnated, and Europe certainly. But that's only been the case for the past maybe a century, and we haven't lived but, a few days compared to the church. The church has been around for 2,000 years. Its progress and decline should be measured by, you know, looking at least in increments of centuries rather than decades or years. And certainly, if we look at the last couple of centuries, Christianity has expanded incredibly worldwide. And, we've got a bit of a, you know, a log jam here in Western Europe and America. But that could break free. You never know. And there could be a flood of revival. I'd like to think so. There's certainly no reason to not pray for it.
Certainly. Might I ask you another question on a different subject?
All right.
It came to my attention last week that the Catholic Pope has now said that he believes that it's ungodly to condemn murderers to capital punishment, and people are chiming in with opinions on that. Do you have thoughts on the Christian movement making the declaration on that subject? We know that they shouldn't be interfering in politics unless they're in that position. But do you have an opinion on capital punishment and whether it's appropriate or not?
I have an opinion about it, and it's different than when I was younger. When I was young and more governed by emotion, I would have spoken differently than I do now. But since I've studied the scriptures more over the past five decades, I've come to adjust my thinking more. As I understand it, first of all, everybody's going to die, but there's another judgment at the end. And therefore, though sometimes very innocent people die very young, babies, for example, little children, and sometimes very guilty people live a long time, but everybody eventually dies. Now, God has declared how certain people are supposed to die. We don't know how everyone's supposed to die, but we do know how certain people are, because God gave a long list of activities in the Old Testament that if a person did them, they should die. Now, not all of those things should be enforced today, because a lot of that was part of Israel's special covenantal status. But in the New Testament, we still see Paul talking about crimes that are worthy of death. And, of course, one that all governments have historically recognized is that murder is a crime worthy of death. And so I do believe that if a government, I don't think Christians should execute anyone, but if a government executes its criminals who are worthy of death, then that government has simply exercised a just action. I remember hearing a Jewish rabbi say many years ago that the Jewish view from the Old Testament was that if you do not execute a murderer, then you're placing a higher value on the murderer's life than on the life of his victim. And, of course, that's a very reasonable suggestion. The Bible doesn't say it like that anywhere, but that's obviously a reasonable way to look at it. You're saying, well, you did a bad thing. You took this man's life, but we're not going to hold your life against it. You know, his life isn't as valuable as yours is. We're going to keep you alive, even though you didn't value his life. And that was a more traditional Jewish way of looking at it, but it's actually not an unbiblical way of looking at it. Paul talks about crimes that are worthy of death. For example, in Acts 25, he talks about his own case when he was on trial for his life. And he said, if I've done anything worthy of death, I don't object to dying, but I haven't done anything like that. So Paul made it very clear. If he had committed a capital crime, he didn't object to being executed. He had no objection in principle to it. Now, of course, many people bring up as a response, but there have been people executed who weren't really guilty. And that, you know, modern DNA evidence has shown that some people who were convicted of murder, turns out they really weren't guilty at all. And, yeah, that's true. And they shouldn't have been convicted if they're not guilty. That's a problem with the court system. That's not a problem with defining penalties. To say that a person who is murdered deserves to die is not the same thing as saying a person who's wrongly convicted of murder deserves to die. The problem of convicting someone who is innocent is a court problem. It's not a law enforcement problem. It's a problem with the procedures of the courts. And certainly nobody should be condemned to die who is not manifestly guilty of a capital crime. But to be put to death, you see, is just another way of dying. The criminal that you don't put to death is still going to die. Now, the real issue is a person needs to face God someday. And what God decides in that situation is going to be what determines justice. I don't know that we'll ever have perfect justice in this world. And even you mentioned God judging nations. Sometimes we wonder, why did God judge that nation? But here's a nation much worse that isn't being immediately judged. Habakkuk had that problem because God was judging Jerusalem by bringing the Babylonians against them. But the Babylonians were a lot worse than Jerusalem. And Habakkuk, the prophet, said, why are you doing that? You know, they're worse than us. But God said, well, they'll get theirs in their due time, too. In due time, God settles all the scores. But in the immediate present, we don't see all the scores balanced. We don't see all the scales balanced. So we can certainly do our best to define what justice is, what justice looks like. We can do our best to promote it any way we can. But we have to live with the unfortunate fact that sometimes justice is not served in the fallen world. But God will right all wrongs eventually. Not in this life. Perhaps.
Thank you, Chris. Sorry.
That's all right.
Thank you for your insight. I appreciate it, as always. And I'll continue to listen and read and learn. And God bless you.
All right, John. It's good to hear from you. Thanks for joining us. Let's see. Our next caller is Bruce from Beaverton, Oregon. Bruce, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good to talk to you, Steve.
Yeah.
I keep hearing these folks that are really interested in prophecy, like Jan Markell, who's on about 800 radio stations, Understanding the Times, and some of her other folks like that. And the point they start with is, why is it so important to read prophecy? Because one-third of the Bible is prophecy. I wonder how you take that and try to get a sense of, do you share that feeling that, gee, so much of the Bible, one-third, is prophecy, and that's one excellent reason why we should really be focused on prophecy?
Well, about a fifth of the Bible is law, And I don't know that that means we need to focus on the law all the time. The truth is there are probably, I haven't done the calculations, but as I think about it, there's probably about a third of the books of the Bible are prophetic books. or maybe a third of the pages of the Bible are occupied with books of prophecy. But most of those prophecies, well, frankly, most of the Old Testament prophetic books are not just full of predictions. There, a lot of them are denunciations and things like that of sinful nations, and you know, they're peppered with predictions of judgment and so forth. Of the judgments that are predicted, it can be, I think it's universally believed by Christians that most of them, and some Christians think all of them, have already been fulfilled. But even if you don't believe all the Old Testament predictions have been fulfilled, certainly most of them have been. The fall of Babylon, the fall of Assyria, the fall of Edom, the fall of Moab, the fall of the Philistines, certainly that, those are all past history, and that's what most of that stuff is about. So, there's a lot of prophecy in the Bible. The question is, what is the part of the Bible that's most relevant to the Christian? Now, I mentioned there's several books, several long books in the New Old Testament of law, and yet law is not, the law of Moses is not directly applicable to us as Christians. It is secondarily, we can sort of see the spiritual lessons in the law and so forth, but it certainly is not our focus to focus on the Torah. We focus on Jesus. Likewise, Old Testament prophecies about kingdoms that have risen and fallen and are part of ancient history, there's value in studying those things. You certainly learn about the character of God, and you certainly learn about how God is faithful to predict things that actually ended up happening and so forth. Those are all positive impressions we can get from the prophets. And I would certainly say Christians who altogether neglect them are missing out. But the part of the Bible that's written for the Christian church, for Christians, is the New Testament. Now, I believe we should be very knowledgeable about the Old Testament. But we have to realize that what we focus on in terms of, you know, training people, when it comes to discipling people, Jesus said, disciple the nations by teaching them to observe all things I have commanded you. So it's the things that Jesus commanded that we teach people to observe. As Jesus said, that's how you make disciples. So to spend a lot of time merely talking about Bible prophecy, that is not a New Testament practice at all. I mean, Jesus very rarely spoke of prophecy. He did a few times. Paul interspersed some things about Bible prophecy in his writings, but most of his writings are writings of direction and instruction to Christian living. Same with the other epistles in the Bible. Revelation is prophecy, but it's the only book in the New Testament that's entirely made up of prophecy, and it doesn't make up a very large portion of the New Testament. So I would say prophecy has its place, but it isn't pride of place in the Christian emphasis. At least I don't think it should be. Yeah. Apparently, whoever formed the canon didn't think it should be either.
I love that answer, and the point about one-fifth of the Bible being the law, and I think your point about the New Testament, you know, Jesus has the Olivet Discourse, and we have some of those things, but your point is that it's certainly not one-third of the New Testament, right?
Absolutely not. No, only one book, only of 27, out of 27 books in the New Testament, one of them is a book of prophecy.
Yeah, and I think there's sort of like a cottage industry that's built up about...
Well, there is, and, you know, I don't know the person you mentioned who's on a lot of stations. I think you probably are using hyperbole when she's on about 800 stations. I think Rush Limbaugh is on about 600.
No, that's what they put out as fact.
Well, then, that's amazing, because I think I heard that Rush Limbaugh was on something like 600 stations, which is, I would have thought he'd be on more, but... If somebody's on 800 stations, they're spending millions of dollars a month. I know, because I know what we have to pay stations. But you see, if they are spending millions of dollars a month on radio, well and good, they have every right to do so. But the reason that money's coming in is because there is, in fact, a very saleable message that people want to buy and want to hear about the end times. And so you do see a lot of programs on the air that are focusing on those things. Hey, Bruce, I need to move along, but I appreciate your call, brother. God bless you. Our next caller is John from McKinley, Texas. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
I have a couple of questions. My first question would be about Ephesians 6:12, about how we we wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and the powers of the other side. I guess my question would be, how does that tie in with sleep paralysis and all the events that people are having issues with as far as being, I mean, I've dealt with this personally, being, I guess you would say, messed with in their sleep, held down, woken up. There's been a couple of times that I...
Well, let me just ask you, let me jump in here and ask you, what have you done when those things have happened?
Well, I didn't know it for a long time, but I actually learned by calling out Jesus' name.
And
it
what happened? What happened when you did that?
It stopped. I immediately woke up, and as soon as I said it, I woke up, and the whole thing stopped.
Well, you know what, John? I've heard lots of people tell exactly that same story, so I believe it's true. I've never had that experience myself, but I've been in the ministry for 50 years, and I've been all over the world, and people all the time have told me that very same story about their own experience. So I take that at face value. Now, someone brought up sleep paralysis on this program a few weeks ago, I suppose it was, and I did mention that I just took it for granted that it's a demonic attack, and somebody later responded to me saying it was, it should be considered a medical thing, and I shouldn't.
I know that this is, God created this world, but it's ran by Satan, and over the last year I've learned more things that I could have ever imagined, and how, there's just, it's everywhere, and...
Well, as for your question of how does Ephesians 6:12 relate to that kind of thing, the passage in Ephesians 6 is not primarily about personal demonic attack like that. I mean, I believe that is demonic attack, and I believe we do have victory over it, and I think your own testimony tells us that, but other testimonies I've heard, also the scripture says it, that Jesus said, I give you authority over serpents and scorpions and over all the power of the enemy, and nothing shall by any means hurt you. It says in 1 John 4:4, greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. In James 4:7, it says, resist the devil and he'll flee from you. So we can see that, the Bible does teach that when there are attacks against us by such demonic forces, that we do have victory in the name of Christ and the authority of Christ over them. Though Ephesians, I think, is talking more about the general aspects of the Christian life rather than special, supernatural, freaky things that happen. I mean, there are those things, and I'm sure that Paul was very much aware of those things, but he's talking about the whole Christian life, essentially, as a warfare. And he gives the armor of God as things like the belt of truth and the shield of faith and the breastplate of righteousness and the helmet of salvation and so forth. And these are very generic Christian, assets God has given us, righteousness and truth and faith and salvation. And he's talking about in general that we're living in a world of conflict where, frankly, the enemy's devices are lies and condemnation and doubt and that kind of thing, and that we have been adequately equipped through the normal resources God gives to his people, salvation, faith, righteousness, truth, those kinds of things. Those are the things that protect us in a world where the devil hurls all kinds of things at us. Now, the things you're describing, I think, would fall into the category of things that the devil hurls at us, but I think Paul's thinking more of the generic things like, deception, condemnation, the kind of things that Christians face every day in the world that's run by, evil forces. So I would think that what you're describing would be included among the wiles of the devil that Paul speaks about, but it's not his main focus. I think that what you're experiencing is reasonably common because, at least I assume it, because of the number of people who've told me that they've had that experience. But it's not so common that everyone here can relate with it. For example, I've never had that particular thing happen to me. I've encountered demon-possessed people before, but I've never had a demon, visit my room and, press down on me while I was sleeping and try to choke me and things like that. I know that that happens to a lot of people, but it doesn't happen to most people. So I think Paul's addressing the warfare of the church more in terms of its holistic picture. And the specifics of dealing with demons, I think, would be a subcategory of that, which you can count on, that if you call on the name of Jesus and trust in him, then even these supernatural kinds of attacks can be defeated. That would be my position on that. All right, we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we will take more calls. Some of our stations leave us at this point, but most do not. We go on for another half hour, and I want you to know that if you can't hear the other half hour on the radio station you're listening to, you can at least get it from our website if you want to listen to it streamed there at thenarrowpath.com, or you can get the mobile app. And I know some of the files on the mobile app have been disabled or were not working for a while. I was just informed today the verse-by-verse lectures are now operational on the Apple app, thenarrowpath.com. We are a listener-supported ministry. We pay for time on the radio stations. We don't sell anything or have any commercial sponsors. If you'd like to write to us, you can at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92591, or go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, if you'd like. Please stay tuned. We'll be back.
As you know, The Narrow Path radio show is Bible radio that has nothing to sell you but everything to give you. So do the right thing and share what you know with your family and friends. Tell them to tune in to The Narrow Path on this radio station or go to thenarrowpath.com where they will find topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all the radio shows. You know listeners supported Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share what you know.
And we're taking your calls. If you have questions, the number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. My producer and call screener was talking to me during that 30-second break, and he said that a caller had called and asked him to ask me to say something about the current financial needs of the ministry. In general, the ministry is doing fine. We've been on the air for 20 years. Over the years, we've sometimes had to drop some stations just because, you know, we didn't get enough money to keep those stations on the air. Right now, we've got lots of stations, but there are some that are definitely not, they're in regions from which there are no donors and frankly, no phone calls either. So there are stations that we don't hear any response from at all. And there are a number of them where we do get phone calls, and we're glad to be getting those phone calls, but where there's actually been no support for them. In general, I'm not going to list the stations, but in general, if you're listening to us on a station that we've been on for, let's say, less than a year, and there are several stations like that, especially on the East Coast, we probably haven't gotten anything from those stations yet, and so they're on trial. That is to say, we're on there on a trial basis, and if support comes in, we stay. That's just how it works. Now, there are stations we've been on for a couple of years or more where we're definitely underprovided for. But the biggest need right now is that we would like to expand our Los Angeles program from the half hour that it now is to the whole hour. Now, that's a very expensive thing. And I actually got a check in the mail from trying to remember where it was. I think it was from Seattle area or something, from someone said they wanted to apply it to the Los Angeles expansion. So that was nice because there's, of course, more potential audience in Southern California than, frankly, anywhere else we're on the air. But I don't have the specifics in front of me. I don't handle the finances, actually. Someone else does. And I get reports from time to time about how we're doing. So what I remember from the last report is, of course, the brand new stations we're on, we've got nothing from. And that's not very unusual. But, of course, if we don't get anything from them before long, we'll wonder whether to stay on there. It's more the concern is for the stations we've been on for a couple of years or more. And we might have gotten something from them, but not enough to keep on the air for very long. So just know that, I mean, I don't take any money from this ministry. There's no one who does. We don't have any paid staff. We don't have anyone who gets perks. I don't get perks from this ministry. I'm an unpaid volunteer, and so is everybody else who works here. We have absolutely no overhead. We do have the expenses of radio stations, and every dollar that's sent in goes to pay for radio stations. And, you know, the volunteers are often people who are retired or people who are giving their spare time, and they don't want any pay, just like myself. We don't want any pay for this, but we do want to keep on the air if possible, if the Lord wills. And if the Lord wills, then we look for that, you know, income. So that's all I'll say about that. If people wanted more detailed information, you know, you can write to Frank, who's our financial guy. And I think there's a way to write to him at the, I think if you go to the donate link at our page, there's, I think, an email there for donate at thenarrowpath.com or something like that. That goes to Frank. He'd be glad to give you the specifics. I don't know the specifics because I don't actually get involved with the finances of the ministry very much. All right, let's talk to Greg from Eugene, Oregon. Greg, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Yeah, first I wanted to say that I really appreciate your focus on facts. You know, I hear a lot of lies on a lot of that from preachers and different radio stations. You can lie about truth, but it's kind of hard to lie about that. So what I was hoping to get from you is some dates on when, if you knew, when Gnosticism began and when Peter arrived in Rome to take over the church there, to lead the church in Rome. But
okay,
right about the time that he did that, he met with Simon, the Magi.
The sorcerer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, his meeting with Simon, the sorcerer, Simon Magus, as he's called, was in Acts chapter 8. And it would have been, I think, a long time before Peter would have gone to Rome. It wasn't just before. But according to some of the church tradition, both Paul and Peter were later living in Rome and were martyred there. And they did encounter Simon Magus there as well. But that's in church tradition. That's not mentioned in the Bible. Now, we don't have any biblical evidence that Peter ever led the church in Rome. This is a Roman Catholic claim that Peter was the founder and first bishop of the Roman Church. And it's based on that claim as well as the claim of apostolic succession and the priority of Peter. There's like three different claims Catholics make that can't be found in Scripture. But based on these three claims, the authority of the Pope today is established. So one of the claims they make is that Peter was the first bishop of the Church of Rome. We don't have any record in the Bible of Peter going to Rome, but the traditions of the church are that he died there. So apparently he went there sometime before he died and was killed in the persecution that Nero instigated against the church, and around the same time Paul did, probably. Now, as far as evidence that Peter was not in Rome earlier than the end of his life, we do have the Jerusalem Council in Acts chapter 15 took place in 50 A.D., which would be 20 years after the crucifixion, and Peter was still living in Jerusalem. Peter was still there at the council. Now, he apparently at some point after that went to Rome, but he may not have been there, apparently was not there, even in about 57 or 58 A.D., almost 10 years after the Jerusalem Council, because Paul wrote his letter to the Roman church there, and he greeted about 16 people that he knew there, but he didn't greet Peter. That is, I think Paul did not regard Peter to be present there, or else he would have greeted him too, which is not positive evidence, but it's some indication that Peter may not have gone to Rome even before then and was not there.
So is that his first arrest? Paul's first arrest?
Paul didn't write the Roman epistle from prison, but he did eventually end up imprisoned in Rome, as you mentioned, twice. Paul came to Rome around 60 A.D. as a prisoner. He was imprisoned in Jerusalem around 58, spent 2 years in prison in Caesarea, and then he was shipped off to Rome, where he was at least 2 more years in prison. It is believed by most, I think, that he was released from that imprisonment for a while and later was arrested again and didn't get out of that one alive. So there were two.
He went with Priscilla and Aquila to.
That was in the movie. That was in the movie about the Apostle Paul. But yeah, that was fiction. Priscilla and Aquila were in fact in Rome at the time that Paul wrote the Roman epistle. They may still have been there when Paul went there as a prisoner, but there's nothing mentioned of it in the Bible. But the point is, though, that when Peter went to Rome, we do not know. But the evidence would be he didn't go there very early. And if the Church of Rome had a bishop in its first few decades, it wouldn't have been Peter. So he wouldn't have been the first bishop of Rome. We don't even know if he ever did become a bishop of Rome. That's just a Catholic tradition. Now, as far as Gnosticism is concerned, most scholars say that it arose as a real force of opposition to Christianity in the second century and was a serious problem in the second and third centuries because many of the church fathers wrote against it then. But there's some evidence that in Colossians and in 1 John that there was some encroachment of ideas that we later associate with Gnosticism. It may have been developing in the end of the first century. No one knows exactly when it began, although the church historian Eusebius attributed its origins to Cerinthus, who lived in Ephesus around the same time that the Apostle John did.
What was that name again?
Cerinthus. C-E-R. I think it's E-N-T-H-U-S. So that would be, you know, no one knows the exact dates that arose, but it was rising in the late first century, and it became very dominant heresy in the second and third.
I know in Valerianism, it's really dominant, and that's like 160 A.D., I think.
There were a lot.
When he died, 169 or something like that. 65.
There were a lot of branches of Gnosticism. I mean, Manichaeanism later on was a problem, and it was based on Gnosticism, too. Docetism was a branch of Gnosticism. Gnosticism had its various teachers, and they all taught something a little differently, so it wasn't like a unified movement.
Seemed like it's from the looks of what I've read on it is that it was based in Egyptian cults.
Well, it certainly had its roots in Greek philosophy, but Greek influence had come to Egypt several centuries before Christ through Alexander the Great. So it may have mixed some of the Egyptian cultic information with the Greek philosophy. It was a mixture. It's basically a parasitical kind of philosophy that attached itself to other religions. There was a Gnosticism that attached itself to Judaism, and then of course there was Gnosticism that attached itself to Christianity, and both of them were perversions of the originals. Listen, I've got a lot of calls to take, but I hope that might have been instructive for you, brother. Thanks for your call. Let's see. Looks like Sam from Dallas, Texas is next. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Sam. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you, Steve?
Good, thanks.
Hey, Steve, I have a question regarding the number 666. Is that a figurative, or there is a different way to see in the future?
Well, I think many scholars, and I would be sort of in their camp, not all scholars see it the same way, but many scholars believe that 666 is an example of what they call the gematria. A gematria was when someone would take the letters of a word, either in Latin or in Greek or in Hebrew, all of which the letters of their alphabet had numerical equivalences. And someone would take the name, the letters of a word or of a name and would calculate the numeric equivalence of each letter and then add them up. And so there are known cases of this outside of the Bible, just from archaeology and so forth, of the gematria, people using these numeric substitutions for names that are based on the total of the numeric values of each of the letters in the name. So most believe that when John says the number of the beast is the number of a man's name, it is 666, it's generally assumed that this means that if you could calculate the letters, numbers in his name and add them up, it would come up to 666. Now, by the way, some manuscripts say 616, which only complicates things. But I think the better manuscripts all say 666. Now, There have been many people trying to figure out what the number refers to. Apparently it's referring to a man's name. And by the way, John was writing in the first century, and he told his readers that if they were wise, they could figure out who he's talking about. He says, "He that is wise, he that has wisdom, let him calculate the number of the beast, for it's the number of a man's name, and his number is 666. So John is writing to people who's alive at the same time as he is. And he's telling them that they could figure out who he's talking about if they can calculate the number. This would mean, of course, he's talking about somebody living in his own time, or in the time of his listeners. So he can't be referring to someone who'd live at some later time, because how could his readers possibly be expected to figure out the name of somebody who hadn't been born yet or wasn't on the scene yet? So it's my understanding that there was somebody on the scene at that very time who fit the description of the beast described in Revelation 13 in general, and that and that his readers would know who it was. My own belief is it was Nero.
Oh, okay. But what about the next description is like when it said like nobody will buy or sell anything unless they have that mark or that number?
Well, it doesn't say they won't buy or sell anything. It just says they will not be allowed to buy or sell, which is a generic statement that they'll be boycotted. This is a form of persecution that has come upon Christians and Jews in different societies when they were under persecution there. The people just wouldn't do business with them. You know, in Nazi Germany, people were forbidden to do business with the Jewish merchants and so forth. It was an economic persecution of them. This is before they began to be arrested and hauled off to concentration camps. But it's simply referring to a form of ostracism, a form of persecution. People won't do business with you because you're not conforming. You're not fitting into the world's way of thinking and doing things. That's what I think it's saying.
So, in your opinion, in the end time, it won't be that person need to be scared. Hey, I'm not getting this 666 because then buy anything.
Right. Well, the way I understand Revelation, no, it's not talking about the end times. But I will say this, that if anyone ever comes to your door and says, here, you get this tattoo on your hand that says 666, then I'd suggest you refuse it.
Yeah, because I saw on a CNN like a few years back that somebody in Florida, that church pastor, his congregation is getting tattooed 666 as a rebelliousness or whatever. Like publicly, it's been telecast on the CNN a few years back.
Well, I don't know about that case, but that'd be a pretty crazy thing to do. Anyway, I would say that would be a tremendous act of rebellion against God. Maybe the Church of Satan would do that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna take another call because we're running out of time. What's that?
I said thank you so very much for taking my call.
Okay, Sam, it's good to talk to you. Thank you for your call. All right, our next caller is Robert from Massachusetts. Robert, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thank you very much. Steve,
yeah.
There's a long-time debate, Calvinism, Arminianism.
Uh-huh.
What side of the fence are you on?
I'm on the Arminian side.
Salvation. Thank you.
Yeah, I'm on the Arminian side.
Okay.
But let me just say this. It's not that I haven't given a lot of consideration to the Calvinist side. I've read scores and scores of Calvinist books, and I've debated some of the guys who wrote those books publicly. We've had, for example, James White debated me 5 days in a row on this radio program, and I debated another Calvinist named Gene Cook 5 days on my radio program, and I debated no one for 3 days on the radio, a guy named Matt Slick, and I've also debated Doug Wilson up in...
Ask you a question, Steve?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you do with Ephesians 2:1? You who were dead in sins and trespasses have to be quickened.
Yeah.
Luther and Calvin and Edwards and Whitfield all say that a man can make no move towards God unless he be regenerated.
That's what they say, and they base it very largely on the statement that we were dead in trespasses and sins. Now, I would say, wait a minute, why would you interpret dead in trespasses and sins to mean that? I mean, obviously, to say that someone is dead before they're converted is not speaking of literal death, okay? We're not talking about someone being literally having no vital signs. They're a living human being before they're born again. And therefore, Paul's not talking about physical death. He's not talking about literal death. He's talking about something else, which he calls being dead in trespasses and sins. Now, if someone says, well, dead men can't do anything, Well, right. Literally dead men can't do anything, and they can't, you know, literally dead men don't do anything. They don't make any decisions. They don't get married. They don't go to work. They don't wake up in the morning like non-Christians do regularly. He's not talking about people who are dead in the sense that they can't do anything. He's using the term, I believe, the way that it's commonly used in Scripture, when especially among Jews, although Paul is not writing to Jews here, he's influenced by Hebraic thinking. Being dead to somebody was like being disowned by them or being alienated from them. You might remember that the prodigal son, when he came home, his father said, "My son was dead, but now he's alive." He meant he was dead to me.
I got it. Let me ask you another question. Mm-hmm. What about Romans chapter 3, where it says, "There is none righteous, no, not one. There is none who seeks God."
Uh-huh. Well, in answer to that, I would say, if you take that as an absolute statement, which Paul doesn't mean it to be an absolute statement, but he's quoting from a psalm, he's quoting Psalm 14, and even the psalmist doesn't take it as an absolute statement. The psalmist in Psalm 14, three verses later, talks about God is with the congregation of the righteous, or the generation of the righteous. So there are righteous people. Even the psalmist who said, "There's none righteous, no, not one," he talks about that.
After conversion?
No, David wasn't talking about conversion. He's talking just about in Israel, there were righteous people and unrighteous people. But, you know, there's many places in the Bible that talk about righteous people. Old Testament.
Then what do you do with Titus 3:5 that says, "Not by works of righteousness have we done, but according to his mercy he saved us"?
I just take it literally.
Okay, then if there are works of righteousness by a person who is not saved, is that what David's talking about?
Well, when Paul said we're not saved by works of righteousness, he didn't say anything about whether we have works of righteousness. He's just saying any works of righteousness can't save us. There have been many people who've done works of righteousness, but that didn't save them. We're not saved by works of righteousness. We're saved by grace.
Yeah. All right, we agree on that. But if you go back to Romans chapter 3, and it says, "There is none that seeks God," and then Paul categorically lists, 11 negative statements about the nature of total depravity in man?
Well, you have to understand what Paul's doing in Romans 3, and if you listen to my lectures verse by verse on Romans 3, you'll find out that he's quoting from about five different Old Testament passages to make a specific point. He's not all the passages he quotes are poetic and hyperbolic, and he means them no differently than the original authors did. But if Paul really wanted to say that literally and absolutely no one seeks God, then he's going against Scripture all over the place. There's many references to people seeking God in Scripture.
Could you give me a couple?
Oh, yeah. How about Job, chapter 1? He was a man who was eschewed evil and did righteousness and feared God. And, there's a lot of Psalms. I don't have the Psalm there, but just look in a concordance.
I got someone. Go
look in a concordance and look up the phrase, "seek God." And you'll find...
Yeah, hold on a second, Steve.
Yeah.
Go to Acts chapter 10, where Cornelius, Roman centurion, he was righteous. He was seeking God, but
he was
dead in sin.
Right, exactly, which proves my point. That proves my point, that you can be dead in sin and still be seeking God and be righteous, doing righteous things. You're not saved. Being dead means you're alienated from God, just like the prodigal son was alienated from his father when he was away from him. He was dead. But when he came back to his father, who's now alive. But he made the decision on his own when he was in a far country. So I'm going to go back to my dad. When he did, that dead man was now alive again in terms of his relationship with his father. I believe that's the normal way.
Therefore, that when Paul was on the road to Damascus, Paul was saved with his will or against his will?
Well, he wasn't saved against his will, certainly.
You don't think he was saved against his will when he was...
No, it wasn't against his will, because when he wrote to Timothy, he said, "I opposed the church because I did it in ignorance." He didn't know that he was doing the wrong thing. He wasn't against God. He just didn't think Christ was the Messiah. Then when he found out, he changed his tune, just like many people do.
How does ignorance presuppose will? That was his will to torment the church of God.
When Jesus appeared to Paul, Saul, Saul said, "Who are you, Lord?" In other words, he's basically saying, "Okay, you're the Lord," meaning I'm going to follow you, whoever you are. And Jesus said, "It's me, Jesus." So Paul did make a decision that this one who appeared to him was going to be someone he'd follow. Now, later, when he talked to Agrippa, he said, he's telling that very story to Agrippa, and he says, I was not disobedient to that heavenly vision, O King Agrippa. Meaning, you know, I could have been, I suppose, but I wasn't. I accepted what I saw there.
You don't think there's any regenerative power in that blinding light where God's will overcame Paul's ignorance and his resistance?
Well, if there was, the Bible makes no reference to it at all.
Well, then why do you get that term election over 55 times in the New Testament?
You know what I think you need? We're not going to have the complete debate on Calvinism all over here. It takes hours and hours. But I will tell you, if you're interested in knowing what I would say about every verse in the Bible that Calvinists use, because I've culled them from scores of their books, I've got about 50 verses Calvinists use, and I explain each one of them in their context in a series of lectures that you can hear for free from my website. So if you're interested...
Well, I think I'll stick with Romans 3 and Romans 9 and Ephesians 2.
Okay, then look those ones up. Look those ones up,
and
see what they're...
towards God unless God in his mercy moves towards him.
Okay, fine. Well, see, you're certainly welcome to believe that, and you're also welcome to not listen to what I have to say, because no one's obligated to listen to what I have to say. But you're asking me, and so since you're asking me, I thought, well, maybe you want to know what I have to say. Usually people don't ask questions if they don't want to know, I hope. But, you know, if you do want to know, we do have a series of lectures, free. All our lectures are free online. You can listen to it, just download and listen. It's called God's Sovereignty and Man's Salvation. It's 12 lectures. It was a weekend seminar, 12 lectures. I covered every verse that Calvinists use, and I cover both sides of the whole issue of God's sovereignty and man's salvation. Now, you don't have to devote yourself to listening to those. You don't have to listen to even one of them. But if you want to know what I have to say about it, that'd be the best way to find out. I do appreciate your call, but I mean, I have a lot of Calvinists I've debated, usually a lot longer than I can take to debate you here now, nor do I want to debate you. But if you want your questions answered about it, those lectures will certainly give you the answers that I would give. All right, thank you for your call. Okay, let's talk to John from Arlington, Texas. John, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. First Corinthians 3:10-15 has been used by preachers for to make people think that they are wasting their life and that they will have regrets and shame if they don't fulfill God's will for their life. I just wondered if that's a correct interpretation of it.
Well, that's where Paul talks about how he laid the foundation and others build on the foundation, and people sometimes build with wood, hay, and stubble, and some build with gold, silver, and precious stones, and so forth. And he says their works will be tried by fire, and if they're Christians, even though their works are burned up, they'll be saved, yet as by fire. But if their works are made of the right stuff, their works will endure the fire. And so each one will be rewarded according to his works, Paul says. Now, you're right. Preachers often talk about that as if it's talking about Christians who are making a choice to be carnal or to be spiritual, Christians who are choosing to be obedient or not. I don't see it that way. I see Paul is talking about ministers, himself and Apollos. That's the whole subject of chapter 3, how that ministers have to make sure they build on the foundation of the church, which Paul laid, with the right stuff. And he's not really talking about the average Christian life there. Oh, I'm so sorry we ran out of time. I really wanted to talk longer about this. But you can hear my lecture on 1 Corinthians 3 at the website, thenarrowpath.com. I apologize we can't go further than that today. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. As I mentioned, we are listener-supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate if you want to from the website, thenarrowpath.com. But if you don't want to donate, you can go to the same website and take whatever you want for free, because nothing is for sale there at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.